Bookmark with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspirations, rather than books.
Hello and welcome to Bookmark. This is the show that talks about books and writing with a local slant. Our featured guest today is Susanna Gregory, talking about her historical mystery set in 14th century Cambridge. We'll also hear from Patricia Farr about her book Life After Gravity, Isaac Newton's London Career. And Keith Miles and Jackie Lees talk about Bob Dylan in London, Troubadour Tales. Well, Susanna, we'll give you a proper introduction in just a moment. But first of all, welcome to Bookmark.
Thank you.
And we're going to be moving around a lot in time and place today. So we're going from 1960s London to 14th century Cambridge to 17th and 18th century London. And just looking at your biography, you've moved around a fair bit yourself, certainly in terms of careers, haven't you? You've been a police officer, a postdoctoral researcher on seals. You've worked with marine mammals in the Arctic and Antarctic, and you've taught comparative anatomy. So was that the plan? How did you end up doing all those things?
Well, I don't think anyone plans out their life that carefully, but no, I've been extremely fortunate. The police was quite a long time ago. I sort of regard that as my national service. But then I went back into academics and I've just been blessed to have a wonderful time, particularly at Cambridge. I mean, Cambridge was just so wonderful, met so many interesting people and so many opportunities to do my research and to learn about the history of Cambridge, which is why I started writing the books.
In the middle of all that then, were you still writing? Were you always writing?
No, I didn't start writing until about 25 years ago.
What about history? You've always been interested in history.
Yes, I've always loved history, but I have absolutely no formal training in it. So everything I know is stuff that I've learned from going to lectures at the university sometimes, because the lecturers were gracious enough to let me sit in and listen and learn from them, and from all sorts of reading.
And you didn't start writing, as you said, till 25 years ago, but my goodness, you've not stopped since then, have you? You are so prolific. How many books have you written?
52, I think.
That's a lot. Do you have a routine then that you work to produce so much?
Not really. I think the secret, if anyone does want to write a book, is just to sit at your computer and do it. You know, people talk about writer's block. I don't think I believe that exists. I think if you just sit there long enough, something will come out. And as long as you get something on the screen, something on paper, you can always go back later and edit it. So it doesn't really matter what you write, even if it's total rubbish. The point is just get something down and then you can rework it. I know people who work in different ways. My colleague Mike Jex, who also writes medieval mysteries, he writes in a very different way from me. He thinks really carefully about what he wants to do and everything is almost perfect once he gets it down. Whereas I tend to write all sorts of rubbish, get a first draft of perhaps 40,000 words or something, and then go back and rework and rework and rework. And I've probably read it 20 times by the time it goes off to the editor.
And I'm looking forward very much to talking to you about your writing. But we're going to hear now your first choice of music. Before we do, is music important to you, Susanna?
I think with music is that it does take you back to the time that you're trying to write about. And so by listening and letting it fill your mind, you do get a sense of period. And that's why I've chosen these pieces today, really, because they do take you back to a certain era.
Yeah, we're going to start with Miserere Me by Gregory Allegri. Why did you choose this one?
Just because it's one of the most stunning pieces of music ever written, I think. And it's got an amazing story to it. I don't know if it's true, and doubtless some of your listeners will be able to correct me. But the story goes that Allegri wrote it, and it was just for use in the Sistine Chapel. The Pope decided that it was so beautiful it couldn't possibly be heard anywhere else, so he banned it from being performed anywhere else. And the story goes that Mozart, when he was 14, went into the Sistine Chapel and heard it and was able to go away and write it down note for note. And the Pope was so impressed by what he'd done, he said that everybody should be able to listen to it after all, and so it got out into the general population. Don't know if it's true, but it's a lovely story.
That That was Miserere Me by Gregory Allegri, the first choice of music on Bookmark today from our featured guest, Susanna Gregory. Susanna is a prolific writer, as we've heard, of historical crime fiction. Her Thomas Challoner series, set just after the restoration of Charles II, began in 2006 with the publication of the first in the series, A Conspiracy of Violence. Her Matthew Bartholomew series began 10 years earlier. A Plague on Both Your Houses introduced readers to 14th century Cambridge and our hero, the forward-thinking physician Bartholomew. 24 novels later, he survived the Black Death and numerous deadly goings-on, and in The Sanctuary Murders, the most recent novel in the series, he tackles anti-French feeling and convent corruption, amongst many other things. Well, Susanna, as we say, how many novels? 24 novels in that series. Did you ever think it would run that long? Were you always going to write something that was going to be a long-running series?
I don't think any writer ever thinks that. You're just thinking about the one that you're working on, and that's as far forward as you think. Or maybe some people do prepare that far ahead, but I certainly didn't. When I wrote the first one, I wrote it for myself. I'd never intended anyone else to ever see it. But then my husband gave it to somebody in the English faculty at Cambridge to read, and he recommended me to his agent, and it all went on from there. So thank you very much, Charles Moseley, who some of you may well know. He's a lovely local character who writes books himself about Cambridge.
Was it always going to be this period, the 13th and 14th century? Was that where you were always going to set the story?
I've always been interested in the 14th century. I think it's a fascinating period, not just because of the uncertainty of the Black Death, but all the other things that were going on. The country was at war with France, so that was very unsettling for everybody. Various powerful kings died, and so it's an absolutely fascinating time.
And why Cambridge? Because you could have invented an imaginary place, a fictional town or city. Why did you go for Cambridge?
Oh, Cambridge, it's so wonderful. It's such a magnificent place. And just walking along the streets now, you can just feel the history pouring out the stones. It's just an amazing city. When I was writing, I used to get up really early in the morning, particularly in the summer, sort of 4:30 or something, and just walk around the streets when there were no tourists and no ice cream vans, and just look at the place and just sort of absorb the atmosphere, which was just amazing. It's just a lovely city, and I feel very honoured to have lived there for 20 years.
And in the world that you create, I mean, it is quite different to the Cambridge of today, although there are lots of things that we can still recognise too. The main difference I saw when I looked at the map is it's full of priories in the 14th century. I mean, religion was the name of the game, wasn't it?
Oh, totally. In a sense, it makes any kind of historical novel quite difficult to write, because religion would have been so huge a part of lives that people now probably don't appreciate it or understand it. It's very difficult to pass on just how massive a religion was as part of life. And it would be a bit tedious to try to explain that. In a sense, all characters in my books are anachronisms, because they think of something other than religion, and it's not really a dominating force in their lives as it would have been for the real characters. Does that make sense?
It does. And these people who are brothers or friars, they play a significant role in local politics as well.
Yes, they did. The university was a very powerful force in the town, and probably still is, actually. Every scholar in the university would have been ordained into minor orders. Some of them would have been in major orders. They would have been priests. Not very many monks, but certainly lots of priests. Mendicant orders, particularly the Dominicans and the Franciscans, were very powerful, and so were the Carmelites. Everybody would have been a son of the church, so to speak. During the Black Death, the church authorities allowed deacons, so anybody that had taken minor orders, to give absolution at the time of death, because the situation was so desperate. For example, during the Black Death, virtually all the Dominicans died, because they didn't just sit back and lock themselves in their priory. They actually went out and ministered to the sick. And of course, they got it and died for their pains, basically. And so deacons like Bartholomew would have been going out hearing confessions, giving absolution and so on the deathbed, which would have been vitally important to people. They were really concerned for their immortal souls in those days.
And what about researching this period then? Where did you go to find out all these facts?
There's the university library, which has a magnificent collection of books. Obviously, it's a copyright library, so anything and everything that's been written is there. So the university library was a major resource. It was wonderful. It's also got some original manuscripts that I could see as well. They display some of them. You can go in and just admire them, just look at the beauty of them. And once or twice, they even let me see some. and the Fitzwilliam Museum, actually. There's a coin expert there that actually let me hold some 14th century coins that would have been used by some of the people in the books, which was an amazing sensation.
And lovely. And in terms of the, I've mentioned the Sanctuary of Murders, which is the latest one in the Bartholomew series. And that's set just after the French invasion of Winchelsea, which I didn't know had happened. You base some of the novels on real events and real places. How much liberty do you feel you can take? It's quite a long way back, and I suppose only experts in that period will challenge you. But how much wriggle room do you give yourself in geography and facts?
Well, if I make mistakes, people tend to write. I do get quite a number of letters from readers who say, oh, this wouldn't have happened, or they wouldn't have done that. Or I actually got one from somebody in the Royal Numismatic Society who wrote and told me I'd left a coin on a doorstep and I said it was brown. And he wrote and said, you know, this is absolute rubbish because everybody knows that bronze brown coins didn't come out of the mint until late in 1353. And this is early in 1353. So you've made this terrible mistake and it ruined the whole book for me. So actually, after that, I happened to be in the library in Cambridge, the local library. There was a book for sale and it said The Coins of Britain from Norman Times onward. And I thought, OK, I shall buy this and I shall never upset this poor gentleman again. So I took it home and opened it up to the 14th century and somebody had ripped the pages out.
Oh, no.
So the two pages I needed were missing. To this day, I'm convinced it was him.
Do you ever think of the comparisons between then and the present day? I'm just reading the Sanctuary Murders, as I say, this anti-French feeling. Of course, I couldn't help but think of the recent Brexit debate and the antipathy that was shown towards foreigners. Does that ever strike you, the similarities between then and now, even though it was a long time in the past?
Yes, it does. And I think novels allow you a chance to stand on a soapbox and say the things that you want to say. And one of the things that does bother me, obviously, is intolerance and ignorance, as it bothers us all. And so it actually allowed me to explore that a little bit and assess how some of the characters would actually deal with this. Isnard the bargeman, who's a Cambridge man, was among all the rioters at the end of the book, trying to get these strangers out. And the point was, I think, that bigotry is still right in the middle of us and we need to do all we can to fight against it.
And the animosity between the university and the town, which there are still some tensions there between those two sectors. But in your books, I mean, that is really on a knife edge at times, really harsh.
You can understand it, really. There was dear old Cambridge happily bumbling along in the 13th century, minding its own business. And all of a sudden it found it had a nest of scholars in its midst. And they came in and they were subject to a different law because they could all read and write. So they were subject to church law rather than secular law. So if they killed somebody or stole, they'd have a much lighter sentence than the Cambridge folk, which the Cambridge folk thought wasn't very fair. So yes, you can understand them, the locals being a bit resentful of these strangers probably coming into their midst and taking over. For example, Great St. Mary's was the biggest church and it was the only one where all the scholars could actually fit in it. So they decided to take it over, which must have been really galling to the people who built it, who suddenly found themselves second-class citizen in their own town. However, that said, when the university was first founded, it's probable that there was a big rioting in Oxford. And so the scholars from Oxford came to Cambridge to sort of wait until all the trouble died down and probably didn't have any intention of founding a university here. But once they were here, they presumably decided it was a good place to be. And so the university was gradually established.
And in terms of the geography of Cambridge, you can still see, obviously, some of the remnants of the time period that you're writing about. You mentioned the Round Church. There are sort of references to a leper chapel or to a place where lepers are. So that time period is still very much in evidence here.
The leper chapel at Stourbridge is still there. It's absolutely beautiful, beautiful mouldings around the windows. And if you can get the key and go in, it's really well worth a visit. So originally there were three so-called leper hospitals in Cambridge. One was around St. John's and the other one was one I was writing about, which was at the corner of Lensfield Road and Trumpington Road. Nothing remains of it now, although apparently some of the almshouses that were part of the leper chapel were still there in the mid-19th century. It's very strange that they actually founded a leper hospital then, because leprosy really wasn't in England at that time. It hadn't been known for some years. So perhaps it wasn't a colony for lepers. Perhaps it was a hospital for those with skin conditions and perhaps even with mental issues.
And in terms of the police work, what I really liked about the novels was obviously this is well, pre-age internet. It's good old fashioned police work, isn't it? It's good old fashioned looking for clues, sorting out the rumours from the truth, because the way that communications travel is a little bit haphazard. And so it is really good old feet on the floor, being in the place, looking for signs. And in terms of writing it, you're therefore having to place clues and think, you know, well, how long would it take to get from this end of the city to that end of the city? When that's the only way people can talk to one another.
I remember once conducting an experiment. It was in London, actually, and my character there had to run from one end of Cheapside to the other. And I looked at the map and I thought, anyway, I'm going to have to do this. I'm going to have to go and do it myself just to see how long it takes, you know, to run from one end to the other and then to walk quickly. And so I did that 3 or 4 times to just make sure I got the timing right. When I was doing that, my editor said, I'm glad that you went and ran up and down Cheapside, because I was editing another book by a rather more famous writer, and she learned how to fly a helicopter. I thought, OK, my run wasn't quite that big.
No helicopters in the 14th century.
It put me in my place somewhat.
Well, thank you, Susanna. We'll come back to you in a moment. But you mentioned London there, and let's go to London now with Patricia Farrer and her new book. Patricia lectures in the history of science at Cambridge University, where she's a fellow of Clare College. Her previous books include Science, A 4,000-Year History, and Pandora's Breaches, Women, Science and Power in the Enlightenment. Life After Gravity, Isaac Newton's London Career, published last month, examines the lesser-known later period of Newton's life, away from Cambridge and apple trees. When I spoke to Patricia, I asked her why she'd written the book.
Well, Isaac Newton is such a famous British hero, but the only thing that most people know about him is that he supposedly sat under an apple tree and watched the apple fall and conceived the theory of gravity. And people also know that he was a very reclusive Cambridge professor, perhaps a bit eccentric, playing around with alchemy. But I wanted to write a different version of Isaac Newton. In the last 30 years of his life, he spent living in London. And while he was there, he still continued his scientific interests, so he was president of the Royal Society, but he also ran the Royal Mint. And that's a situation roughly equivalent now to being the governor of the Bank of England. He also became quite wealthy. He invested a lot in the stock market, and in particular, he invested in several companies, like the East India Company, for example, which were profiting from the global trade in enslaved peoples.
What was his moral perspective on that? Where were his morals then?
Well, I don't think that he was any more immoral than anybody else at the time. The British economy depended on the international slave trade. And there were many very, very eminent people who thought we had to continue capturing people in Africa and sending them across the Atlantic to work on the plantations and down the silver mines in the Americas. So I think it would be very unfair to single out Isaac Newton as particularly immoral. On the other hand, it is also true that his wealth and his reputation depended on the international slave trade. So for one thing, his personal wealth depended on it, because he invested in the stock market, he invested in companies like the South Sea Company and the East India Company. He was also in charge of the mint. The mint was making gold coins, and the gold to make those coins came from Africa. So one of his responsibilities was to vet that gold and make sure that he got the best possible price from the traders who were selling it to him in the African coast. And the third way I think that he benefited from it is when he was correcting his Principia. The Principia is his great big book on gravity. He needed measurements of the tide in different places around the world. So if you're looking for measurements of tide, you write to people who are based in ports. And the people who were based in ports were mostly merchants who were involved in the East India Company or other trading companies, and so also were involved in this global trade, the circulation of people and goods and objects. And so this famous book does have within it data that Isaac Newton has collected from global trading stations positioned around the world.
It seems a life of two halves when you describe it like that. Was it that his younger days were spent studying physics and then his later days were in commerce? Or was there crossover? Was it perceived as more of a crossover in those days?
At Cambridge, he was politically very active. He was a very strong supporter of the Whig Party. before he even went to London, while he was in Cambridge, he was MP for Cambridge University two times. So up until 20th century, Oxford and Cambridge University sent their own MPs to Parliament. And twice Isaac Newton was one of them, although there's no record that he actually said very much, although he did once ask for a window to be opened because it was a bit stuffy. So he was obviously doing a lot of wheeling and dealing that people hadn't really been interested in looking for. And the evidence has always been there, but most of Newton's biographers have focused exclusively on his physics. And I just wanted to see him from a slightly different perspective. And of course, I don't want to undermine or understate his great scientific contributions, but he was doing a lot of other things as well.
And you've used a painting as the framework for studying this part of his life. Why did you do that?
William Hogarth is very well known as a Newtonian painter. A lot of William Hogarth's paintings have got Newtonian references in them. And the painting that I found, it was painted a few years after Isaac Newton's death, and it was commissioned by a man called John Conduit, who was married to Isaac Newton's niece. And what it shows is the drawing room of John Conduit's house, and there's a bust of Newton sitting on the mantelpiece, and then there's a play being performed by some children on a little makeshift stage. And there's an audience which is full of aristocrats, the sort of world that Isaac Newton moved in. I decided in a way to carry out a bit of a biographical experiment. I think it's always terribly boring if you do what's called a womb to tomb or cradle to grave biography, when you start when someone's born and you just plod on through their lives until they die. So what I've done is use this picture to present three different aspects of Newton's life. And I've structured the book as though it were a play in three acts. And first of all, I talk about Newton's relatives and his family and the people he moved with. Then I go on and I talk sort of more about his science. But the third section is all about his activities at the Mint. And the significance of the picture is that it's a painting of four aristocratic children performing a play written by John Dryden. It was originally a restoration play from the 1660s. And what the play tells is the story of the Spanish imperialists who went out to Mexico and conquered the local people and exploited all of them for gold. So I use that play as a way for thinking about the activities of British people on the coast of West Africa during the first half of the 18th century.
And using that painting, did that take you down any alleyways or paths of discovery that you hadn't expected to go down when you were looking at his life?
Well, yes, it encouraged me to sort of think sideways. So, for example, it's John Conduit's drawing room, and there's two pictures on the wall. One's John Conduit and one is a portrait of his wife, Isaac Newton's niece. Not that much has been written about her. So I started doing some reading, and then I started focusing on the big scandal at the time. Did she or did she not have a love affair with a man called Charles Montagu, who was the Chancellor of the Exchequer, and he was Newton's great patron? They're all facts, but you can imagine there was loads of speculation, especially after Charles Montagu left Isaac Newton's niece, Catherine Barton. He left her an absolute fortune in his will. So that was something that I got very interested in, and I tried not to be too salacious and gossipy about it. I've tried to separate out what we actually know and what might have happened and what people speculated at the time.
And is there anything we can learn about Newton's life for today and apply it today by looking at this period of life? Is there anything we can take forward into the present
day? Yes. One of the great slogans of the Whig Party was the idea of liberty and equality. And those are absolutely wonderful ideals. But what happened at the end of the 17th century is a lot of private merchants got together and they protested because at that stage, the slave trade was still in the hands mainly of the crown. And what these merchants said was, now we live in the land of liberty and equality, we should be free to buy and sell slaves and make profit from them, just like the crown. So it seems to me a very double-edged sword of liberty. I mean, it's not much liberty involved for the African people who are involved in all of this. We can think a lot about the interactions between capitalism and global trade and science. And the most important message, I think, is that you can't separate science out from everything else that's happening in the world. Science is absolutely packed with personal interests, commercial interests. It was fundamental to the growth of the British Empire. Science is part of civilization and culture and history, and we have to look at that, try and analyze it and see what happened. I mean, my commitment as a historian is I think it's very important to look at the past to understand how we've reached the present. But for me, the whole point of doing that is to try to improve the future. So I didn't write this book in order to badmouth Newton in particular, but to make us more, encourage people to think more honestly and seriously about what our heritage is and what happened, and make sure that in the future, collectively, that we behave much better.
And what about your own relationship with Newton? Has it changed as a result of writing this book? Do you like him more? Do you like him less?
A lot of people who write biographies of Newton tend to be male physicists, and they empathise enormously with him. And when I first started studying the history of science, it was about the same time that gender studies began to be important. But gender studies were always relegated to women. So I started off and I thought, I am not going to be a woman who writes about women. I'm going to be the female historian who tackles the central figure in physics, probably up to the 19th or 20th century. I'm not lumbered with all that emotional baggage of identifying with Isaac Newton. So I've tried to look at him more dispassionately. I've also, I think it's probably the first book about Newton that's got a substantial number of women in it, because although particularly at Cambridge, he lived in a very male world, when he moved to London, he was surrounded by women. He was very close to Queen Caroline in the royal court. And he lived with his niece and he knew various other women as well. So one woman I talk about is a young woman called Elizabeth Tollett, who was a poet. Isaac Newton at one stage lived in the Tower of London because that's where the Mint was based. And Elizabeth Tollett also lived in the Tower of London because that's where her father was based as a naval officer. And she was a very, very clever, mathematically minded young woman. And she wrote poems about Newton. She wrote poems about physics. And she also wrote poems about how her two brothers went off to Oxford and Cambridge. And she was left inside the tower with only her books for company. So I tried to sort of introduce that aspect of what was going on in London as well.
And Life After Gravity, Isaac Newton's London Career by Patricia Farrer, is published by OUP Oxford. And our featured guest on Bookmark today is Susanna Gregory, talking about her Matthew Bartholomew series of mysteries set in 14th century Cambridge. Susanna, you have a special memory of a connection with Newton, at least.
I was actually taking a group of Americans around Cambridge and showing them all the history that was there. And there was one teenager who was about 14 and she was so bored. I mean, I could tell that she was not enjoying it at all. So I showed her the apple tree outside Trinity and said, this is the descendant of the tree that Newton sat under when he saw the apple fall down. And then he devised his notion of gravity. And she looked at me and she said, he must have been really bored. And so I took her to the market where she was much happier.
Well, so far, Susanna, we haven't really talked about your hero in the Cambridge books, Matthew Bartholomew, a forward-thinking physician, isn't he? So he's already sort of slightly separate from the world in which he lives. Was that what you wanted, that he could be on the inside but also observe?
I think it allowed me to see medieval Cambridge through his eyes rather than the eyes of perhaps a real person who would have been very difficult for me to empathise with. In fact, Bartholomew is about the only character in the books who isn't real. All the others, just about, were people who actually really lived, were scholars that really lived. And I'm sure they didn't kill each other and said the terrible things they were, particularly poor old Father William, who I've had being a terrible bigot and very dirty. I'm sure he was a very nice man.
And he's friends with Brother Michael, Matthew. Is Brother Michael a real person?
Well, there was a Michael de Causton, who was the master of Michael House about that time and then went on to become Chancellor of the University. So, yes, he was. He wasn't a Benedictine. There weren't actually many Benedictines in Cambridge. They tended to stay at Ely, which is a massive Benedictine community.
Bartholomew has his own personal story, which is running forward as well and has been running throughout the books. Do you know where that's going?
I knew the events that were going to be coming up. There's a rumour of another plague coming in. There was the French War going on and various sort of national events that were happening. So, yes, I always knew I was going to place him in the middle of that. I knew I was going to send him to France at one point. So yes, I knew the places that he was going to go. And I do have a vision for him and the relationship he has with his Matilda. Of course, the second he marries her, he'll be out of the university because scholars weren't allowed to marry. So I'll have to think about that one.
And it's post-plague, but they're all still living under the shadow of the Black Death. There's a fear of it coming back. Again, reading it, I was struck, of course, by the situation that we are in at the moment.
Yeah, people were absolutely terrified, particularly of dying without absolution, because their souls were so important to them. So it must have been an awful time. I just can't imagine. They say up to a third of the population died. I think in some places, obviously, it was a lot higher. In Cambridge, it could well have been higher because people were living in fairly cramped, quite squalid conditions. So ideal situation for the plague to spread. I can't imagine what it would have been like for them. I mean, it's bad enough for us, but at least we have communication. We can watch the news. We know what's happening. We can look at these global patterns and see where we are. But they had no outside news at all. I mean, they knew the plague was coming. There were rumours about it, just like there was another plague coming. And 1361, another plague does come, and it sort of wipes out those who escaped the first time around. Not as serious as the first wave, but certainly a significant one. And it kept coming back again and again. And they knew this. It must have been absolutely terrifying.
Let's listen to something nice then to take our minds off this. Let's hear your second choice of music now, which is Sound of Trumpet by Henry Purcell. Why this one?
Oh, it's such a wonderful, lively piece of music. So jubilant. And I just like the way the voices sound like trumpets. They weave around each other. And I just think it's a beautiful, uplifting pattern. It also goes rather nicely with Newton. Perhaps Newton would have known this. Perhaps he would have sat and tapped his feet too as he listened to it.
Cambridge 105 Radio.
Join me, Neil Jones, every Tuesday here on Cambridge 105 Radio for the very best from the world of rock. Every week we'll bring you big name interviews, all the latest from the local scene here in Cambridge, and the very best rock songs around. It's 2 hours of rock every single Tuesday from 9 o'clock with me, Neil Jones, right here across the city in South Cambridgeshire on Cambridge 105 Radio.
Need dropping off at work? Missed the bus and must make that urgent appointment? Need picking up after a night out with your mates? Panther Taxis is your Cambridge-based taxi firm with over 700 drivers, offering great rates and local knowledge, ensuring you make it quickly and safely to your destination. We don't inflate our prices at peak times, and all our drivers accept payments by cash or card. Book your taxi the easy way. Download our free Panther Taxis app through your app store and start booking your taxis on the go. Call Cambridge 715 715 or see panthertaxis.co.uk. Panther Taxis, your local, quick, reliable and friendly taxi company in the city.
CKLG Accountants are a friendly team of accountants and tax advisors with big firm expertise.
I'm Sarah, one of CKLG's friendly tax advisors. Creating and preserving wealth is an aspiration for many of our clients. In our complex world of changing legislation and family circumstances, we listen and provide you and your family with bespoke tax advice tailored to your needs.
To find out more, call us on Cambridge 810 100 to arrange an initial chat with one of our specialists, or visit our website cklg.co.uk.
CKLG Accountants, your partner in business, your partner in life.
Bookmark with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspirations, rather than books.
And our featured guest on Bookmark today is Susanna Gregory, talking about her Matthew Bartholomew series set in 14th century Cambridge. Susanna, the position of women, let's talk about that, because you cover that in the novels as well. I mean, your women in the novels are quite feisty, actually, even though they're nuns. They've got lots of energy and oomph about them.
I don't think there's any reason to suppose that there wouldn't have been feisty ladies. To run a priory or an abbey must have been an incredibly taxing job, and there's no reason to assume that they were less good at it than the men. So, yes, I think there were a huge number of very interesting, entertaining, erudite, enigmatic ladies that lived in the 14th century.
And the corruption in the convents and the friaries, there's a lot going on there. They are hot beds of action, aren't they?
Yeah, a bit like government today, I suppose. But yes, all this is a fact of record. You can read the bishop was called to make a visitation to a priory or to a convent, and he'd go, or he sent his representatives, and there were records of how shocked he was by what was going on, and there were men being entertained at inappropriate hours, and what people were doing was selling their friends' room, bed and board, and so the friends would pay the abbey a certain amount and the friends would get this free bed and board, basically, and then of course the money would go directly into the pocket, not of the abbey necessarily, but of the abbess or the prior. So yes, I mean, corruption was just as rife then as it is now, I think.
And not much better in the university. There's all sorts of shenanigans going on there as well.
Yes, and again, most of those are you can find in the historical records. I mean, maybe not as many murders as I've made out, but certainly, yes, everyone was out for their interest and everybody wanted their college to get the best. A lot of rivalry between the colleges.
And lots of ritual involved in college life. Are those rituals still there? Can you still see the remnants, the history of some of those?
Colleges have their own graces. Religion was an important part of medieval life. You wouldn't have just sat down and started gorging. You would have had, you know, some significant graces at the beginning of the meal. Meals were incredibly important in college life because it drew people together. They couldn't talk during them. They were supposed to listen to the Bible scholar, I think. But you could see that rule relaxing and friendships being formed. And these friendships then would allow people to go out into the world and say, oh, my friend is there in Westminster. He will help me do this. And, you know, jobs for the boys and the same sort of relationships that you can see today with friendships being formed.
And I didn't realise till reading this last novel of yours that French was the language that was spoken by scholars.
Well, Latin would have been spoken, I think, mostly. But yes, the academic or the social elite would have spoken French rather than the vernacular. So there would have been three languages floating around, at least French, Latin and English.
And talking about the vernacular there, Susanna, your books are very accessible because the dialogue is written in modern day English. I mean, obviously, you took a decision at some point to avoid the prithee sirrah sort of approach to medieval dialogue.
Yeah, my friend Edward Marston once said something that stuck with me, and he said that you need to communicate, so drop off all the prithee sirrah stuff. He said otherwise you end up with a sentence like, prithee knave, art thou okay? He said you just pick a style and stick with it, and communication is the important thing.
Well, speaking of modern day, let's come up almost to the modern day and hear from Jackie Lees and Keith Miles. They're co-curators of the Dylan Room at the Troubadour Club in Earls Court, London, and they are both huge Bob Dylan fans. And Bob Dylan in London, Troubadour Tales, is a guide and a history of the impact of London on Dylan and vice versa. They told me about why they'd written the book, and Jackie began by remembering the first time she'd heard Bob Dylan.
I first heard Bob Dylan in my childhood bedroom on the radio. We didn't have pop music in our house, but I could listen to the radio, and a DJ played Lay Lady Lay, and it just knocked my socks off. I was about 13, and I wrote to the DJ to thank him for having played the record. It made that much of an impact on me, and I went down and tracked down some albums of Dylan that following weekend and went backwards in time and explored the music he'd made already, and then forwards from that era. Blood on the Tracks came out, Desire, Street Legal. Yeah, it was just like one lightning bolt, Lee, and I was sold, hooked, loved the voice, just something did it for me.
Well, I was a very, very small child at the Isle of Wight Festival with my auntie, but I was too small to appreciate the music, too small to do anything other than gawp at these strange hippie types that were there. As with a lot of people in England, one of the big key moments was the release, bizarrely, of a greatest hits album, More Greatest Hits, which was a double album. And it brought together all of those 60s and early 60s tracks that we then went to find and went to look for other albums. It was a huge hit in this country, bizarrely, more greatest hits. And that really started, you know, as a teenager, I had pictures of Bob Dylan, Don't Look Back, on my wall. Using More Greatest Hits, you know, a double album that covered various Dylan styles, you then went back through the Dylan of Nashville skyline and you went and explored the blues numbers and the folk numbers. And it's the range. Bob Dylan has produced so much music over the decades, and it's not all easy to put into one category at all. There are many, many categories, and he's wonderful. His country music is so accessible. His blues numbers are so wonderful. You know, he's a great music historian. It's that range. It's the depth. As you grow older, you begin to realize that those wonderful, evocative lyrics mean different things, and you get more involved in that side of things. But also, that is something that you immediately know with Bob Dylan, is that he never sings normal words. Pop songs can be very, very bland affairs, but with Dylan you get so much.
There are over 1,000 books about Bob Dylan. Keith and I, we own quite a few of them between us, but none of them reflected the importance of London to Bob Dylan. I live in London. I've lived in London for 40 years thereabouts. Keith is a Londoner, and we met at London University, so London's always been in both of our blood. And after Dylan got the Nobel Prize in 2016 for literature, we met up and we did a pilgrimage around London locations just to celebrate the fact that we were fans and how brilliant it was that he'd got the Nobel Prize. And there's very little recognition in the places that we went to that Dylan was ever there. It was Keith's idea. He just said, well, we should do a book about Dylan in London. And right from the start, he had these words, Dylan in London. It just seemed to be like a brand. I had to be persuaded because I didn't want to just add another book to the Dylan, you know, this enormous number of books that existed. But he was right. There was nothing about Dylan in London. And it gave us a chance to do a guidebook as well with a map, something very accessible that would hopefully get people that read it to want to explore just as we had. So it was great fun, really. And I think we've plugged a gap.
As part of our pilgrimage, we went round to find the stories and the history at various points when Dylan was in London. And I think what we hope to get across from the book is at various stages in Dylan's career, although some of the stays in London were quite short, a matter of weeks, they were critical times to the development of the greatest of musical artists in our view. London was so important to him over this period of time. And we wanted the map and the guide to reflect the small pubs, the King and Queen, where he first played when he came over here, the winter of 62. We wanted people to know where these places in musical history were. It ranges from the reasonably known, like the Royal Albert Hall, which we hope in the chapter people will learn something more about that and the tours here, to places such as the Savoy Steps, where Subterranean Homesick Blues was videoed as the first music video. We had the burning ambition, Jackie and I, we knew all these stories and we wanted to get them out, you know, and this book is our opportunity to share what we know and love about Dylan and London with the world, really.
One of the most important people he met was Martin Carthy, because when he came in 62, it was the folk scene was quite vibrant in London. And he went away with new tunes, new arrangements. He also increased his literary content of his lyrics. They got deeper after he had a meeting with Robert Graves that we talk about in one of the chapters in the book. So I think where you see the influence of London, because he went back and he redid some of the second album, Freewheeling Bob Dylan. And the artist Martin Carthy says, you see London all over that album, in the tunes, the arrangements, the words as well.
As much as melodies and musical influence that Dylan got, it was that spark. There's a meeting with Robert Graves, who was a huge literary figure at the time, and a lot of the counterculture beat generation revered a book that Graves had written called The White Goddess, which had a lot of mystical images in there. And people have tracked endless numbers of Dylan lyrics that have references back to that triple goddess, if you like. And, you know, Dylan loved all that. He takes from those areas of literature, really. I mean, the Bible is throughout all Dylan works, and it's not just the Christian era sort of, you know, this is the book I live by. It's the stories. He loves the imagery and the stories. Dylan picked up a lot from the folk scene here, which was very, very lively. And also at different points, you know, he came back at the Electric Tour. He was always a musical magpie. So he would often be with musicians here. And London was a big centre for music throughout popular musical history. Dylan first met the Beatles in 1964 in New York at the Delmonico Hotel. They immediately saw they would be changing path. It wasn't just pharmaceuticals that he led them to. It was a much deeper musical path that he was taking, and everyone was following him. It's a huge change through that period. The 60s time when Dylan's in the Savoy Hotel, that is prime swinging London rock and roll time. And the kind of images we have there from that time, a lot of them came out of Dylan. The Rolling Stones immediately got rid of the suits and the short haircuts. The Beatles started writing lyrics that were slightly better than She Loves You, Yeah, Yeah, Yeah. Roger Waters would say that Pink Floyd listened to one side of Blonde on Blonde, Sad Eyed Lady of the Lowlands. It's one track on one side. And they thought, we don't have to write 3-minute singles anymore. We're no good at that, you know. And immediately that was a huge influence on everyone in the London music scene. David Bowie has a homage on his first album. Mark Bolan changed his name from Mark Field to Mark Bolan to reflect Bob Dylan. It's everywhere. It permeates everywhere in the London music scene.
One of the things that we battled with was to try and identify where was the first place that Dylan had got up on a stage in that 1962 trip. Because if you look through the limited number of mentions that there are in other books, there is a bit of dispute about it. So a bit of digging, Keith in particular, one day he said, oh, look at the wallpaper in the back of this picture. It matches this picture. So this must be the first one. I think that was one of the most interesting finds, really, was to finally nail which was the first place, which we say is the King and Queen pub in North London, where he played.
We think there is a real love for London as a city. He almost bought a house here back in the 90s. He got very close, and there's a bit in the book about him startling an estate agent when he was looking around. So he's often looked to be here. And Jackie and I were delighted with quite a few others to have seen him in Hyde Park only at the end of the last tour. And he was happy. He was smiling. He's nearly 80, but he loves doing this. I think whether it be studio albums or live tours, he just loves being around music and musicians. And to have that joy when you're 80 still, after decades of doing this, is just an infectious thing, really. So I'm pretty sure he's going to be back.
And Bob Dylan in London, Troubadour Tales by Jackie Lees and KG Miles, is published by McNidder and Grace. We've been talking today on Bookmark to Susanna Gregory about her Matthew Bartholomew series of crime novels set in 14th century Cambridge. The latest of those is The Sanctuary Murders, published by Sphere. Susanna, we're coming to the end of our time with you, I'm afraid. So what's next for you? You're carrying on with these series, and you've got two series on the go. Have you still got two series on the go? Are you carrying on with both of those?
Yes, I do. I've got the Challoner series set in 17th century London, which is why I was so interested to hear about Newton. Both series are set in times of great uncertainty, because when I chose to write the 1660s, the country was just coming out of 2 decades of massive civil unrest. You'd had the civil wars followed by the Commonwealth, and nobody knew what was going to happen. The king was back on the throne, but he wasn't particularly secure at the beginning. So it was another period of great uncertainty, like the 14th century was, with the plague lurking about.
And a question we ask all our guests on Bookmark is, what are you reading at the moment? What's on your bedside table?
Yeah, it's a biography of Llywelyn ap Gruffydd, who was the last Prince of Wales. And he's one of my great heroes. And we live in South Wales at the moment, so not North Wales, where his princedom was. it's just an incredible story of an incredible man, and I'm really enjoying it. He lived in the 13th century, so not quite Bartholomew, but near enough. So I'm really enjoying that. And the other book I'm reading is one called Happy Families by Julie Marr. I started reading that one last night, and it's about a family who run a Chinese takeaway. And Julie is actually the sister of a friend of mine. So it's set in Carmarthen. So that's rather nice.
Lovely. Thank you, Susanna. We'll come back to you in just a moment for your last choice of music. But a heads up that on our next show, our featured guest is Francis Spufford, talking about his new novel, Light Perpetual. We'll also hear from Geetha Lodge talking about her latest psychological thriller, Lie Beside Me. And Stephen Brotherston and Dave Lawrence will be chatting about Scarred for Life, a review of television in the 1980s. But we'll sign out now. Well, I'll say with your last choice of music, Susanna, it's the last sound, really, isn't it? Why have you chosen this? This is Birdsong. Beautiful.
The Dawn Chorus, which is something that people in the 14th century would have been so familiar with. They would have heard this, probably taken it for granted, and it probably would have been a lot louder because there were so many more birds than there are now. There's a sort of timeless quality, particularly April, May, you go out and all the birds are desperately declaring their territories and sending out their mating calls. It's just loud and vibrant and beautiful. And if you can get out first thing in the morning and listen, it's just so rewarding. It's just wonderful, as I'm sure many of your listeners will know.